Civil Rights, Now and Then, Freedom Summer, Bob Moses, and the Fight for First Class Citizenship.
So finally, Bob Moses and others of SNCC decided we've got to do something different. We've got to bring America into Mississippi. So the idea was to bring 700 or more college students in that summer.
That's Bruce Watson. We talked to him about his terrific new book, Freedom Summer, out from Viking Press.
People in the elite structures in the country have their kids in schools that they know will work for them. And so it's the other people's children that the country has not really come to grips with.
And that's the great civil rights leader, Bob Moses. He talks about the link between the right to vote and the right to a quality education. Moses has edited the new book, Quality Education as a Constitutional Right. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Did you know that Mississippi now has more African-American politicians than any other state? It's come a long way since Jim Crow days, when people were brutally beaten or even murdered for trying to vote, public accommodations were under apartheid, and black children went to schools without textbooks or desks. The edifice of Jim Crow began to crumble in the summer of 1964, and the change took the blood, sweat, and tears of many Americans, white and black. More than 700 young idealistic civil rights workers from across the nation came to Mississippi to register black citizens to vote and open freedom schools for their children. And the political monopoly of the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party was challenged by Fannie Lou Hamer and other black Mississippians at the 1964 National Convention in Atlantic City. It was Freedom Summer. On the very first day of that summer, three civil rights workers, two white and one black, were brutally murdered. But by the end of August, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and the young people it had organized had changed the political landscape of Mississippi forever, and with it, the nation. Later in the show, we'll talk to the man who came up with the idea of Freedom Summer, Bob Moses. But first, journalist Bruce Watson recounts that historic moment in the life of our nation. His book is Freedom Summer, the savage season that made Mississippi burn and made America a democracy. Bruce Watson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Take us back to the start. How did Jim Crow come into being?
It really came out of Reconstruction. I do a whole chapter on Mississippi history in the book in which I try to explain how a vicious and violent summer like Freedom Summer could have happened in an American state, in one American state, and why Mississippi. In fact, Mississippi suffered more in the Civil War than any other state. It lost more people per capita. Its rivers were plowed and its cities were leveled, just very much like Sherman's March, except it happened all over Mississippi. And in the wake of that, Mississippians vowed never to forget. And they also vowed, of course, to preserve, the white Mississippians vowed to preserve their whites-only government. So they drove the blacks who had been voting during Reconstruction and attaining office, they drove them out of office with violence in many cases, and later with a new Mississippi constitution that basically wrote into power white supremacy and Jim Crow laws. And that's where things stood. From 1890, when that new constitution came into effect, all the way until Freedom Summer in 1964. That's the way things stood. And in the 10 years prior to Freedom Summer, there had been all sorts of vicious events, the lynching of Emmett Till and the riots at Ole Miss when they tried to integrate, that had risen to preserve the status quo. And the status quo in Mississippi was 7% of African Americans could vote, just 7%, and they were determined to keep it that way.
Jim Crow was, of course, segregation was far more than just the vote. And the fight against Jim Crow was also about more than the vote. There was an educational component as well, is that right?
Well, Jim Crow was really, many people tend to see it as being about hatred, but it really was less about hatred than it was about a power structure to keep African Americans, quote, in their place, unquote. And part of that, of course, was education. In Mississippi, in particular, despite Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, all schools by Freedom Summer were totally segregated. And not just segregated, but the spending ratios were anywhere from 10 to 1 to 50 to 1 in favor of white schools. There were often 50 or 60 people kids in a black school. The textbooks were ancient. And in fact, that's why one of the most important components of Freedom Summer, I hope we get a chance to talk about, were the Freedom Schools.
Yes, and in fact, I very much want to talk about that. And the third component then was also around getting political power more than with a vote, but within the Democratic Party.
Well, yes, that was what came up in the... after all, if you can't vote, then you can't have your own elected officials. And, of course, all of Mississippi's elected officials were white and had been since Reconstruction. So one of the genius moves, really, of Freedom Summer was called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was started before Freedom Summer, but continued throughout that summer. It was a parallel political party in which people would simply sign up, register, and as Mississippi Freedom Democrats, and they didn't have to worry about being shot at, which might happen if they tried to register at the courthouse, or being blacklisted, or being fired or thrown off their plantation, because no one knew. They simply had these names on record. And toward the end of Freedom Summer, they had 63,000 names. They held their own political conventions, and they sent 67 delegates to Atlantic City to the Democratic National Convention to make their own challenge to the all-white delegation. So that was a very important part of Freedom Summer.
And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. But let's go back to what Freedom Summer was all about. In reading your book, Bruce Watson, Freedom Summer, it really struck me that Mississippi was a state of terror for blacks. Describe a little bit about of what that meant, what that terror meant for people.
Well, they called it, an old Miss history professor wrote a book that summer called Mississippi, the Closed Society. Many people likened it to Nazi Germany, though I don't certainly think it was that bad. But it was a society of, it was basically an apartheid system, or a caste system, if you prefer, in which blacks were kept at the very lowest rung through a variety of social customs and economic customs and job lack of job opportunities. And when anyone dared to step out of line to register to vote at a courthouse or to try to lobby for better schools or even in many cases just to join the NAACP, the terror struck. It didn't happen that often because the terror was always hovering. Everybody in Mississippi, every black person in Mississippi, had a story of a lynching that they had witnessed. There had been some 500 since the 1890s, most of any state in America. And those stories did a very good job of keeping people in their place, so to speak. And so when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, came to Mississippi in the early 60s, their first job was to get people to overcome their fears, because it didn't take much to revive old fears and all the old terrors. And if you dared to step out of line, if you registered to vote, you could be, as I said, thrown off your plantation. Shotgun could be fired into your shack at night. Some people were actually killed, run off the road. Of course, Medgar Evers, the NAACP leader, was gunned down in his driveway. All of that had happened just prior to Mississippi's Freedom Summer.
And Fannie Lou Hamer, she had a story that she told at that convention in Atlantic City, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, when she tried to register to vote. What happened to her?
She had registered. She'd been a lifelong Mississippi sharecropper in Ruleville, Mississippi, right in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. And she went out, she heard SNCC, James Forman, speaking one day, asking for people who were willing to be brave enough to register. She went down to the courthouse. The next day when she came back, or that evening, I think, when she came back, she was told by her daughter that the boss man wants to see you. And he said, "We're not ready for that in Mississippi." And she said, "I didn't go down to register for you. I went to register for myself." Well, she was thrown off her plantation. Where she wound up living, they fired into her shack. And then later, when she continued to do this, she was taken off a bus and beaten, brutally beaten, in police custody. And she told all of that to a nationwide audience at the Democratic National Convention. And she said, in stirring words that you can still hear on the Internet, I think you should listen if you get a chance, "If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because we want to be decent citizens?"
Now, tell us who organized Freedom Summer? How did it come about?
Well, Freedom Summer was very controversial among SNCCs, among the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because their reason for being and their whole philosophy was very different from that of Martin Luther King. They felt that leadership had to come from the ground up. And so SNCS had spent a lot of time in Mississippi, in the Delta, and elsewhere, working with local blacks and trying to empower them and get them to take responsibility and to take leadership roles. But it wasn't working. There was so much stonewalling, there was so much violent backlash, and there was very little publicity coming out of Mississippi. The rest of America just sort of regarded as Mississippi as beyond the pale. Martin Luther King hardly ever went there. It was just seen as the most reactionary state where no progress is going to be made. So finally, Bob Moses and others of SNCC decided we've got to do something different. We've got to bring America into Mississippi. So the idea was to bring 700 or more college students in that summer to register voters, to teach in Freedom Schools, to staff Freedom Houses, and work with local black community. But it was very controversial, as I say, because many people thought that would pull the rug out from under the locals, that if all these highly qualified and articulate white folks came down, they would take the initiative away. And to a certain extent, that did happen. And yet it also, once they decided to go ahead with it, it took on a momentum of its own and really began to change Mississippi for reasons of publicity and other reasons.
And we're speaking with Bruce Watson. His new book is Freedom Summer, The Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and Made America a Democracy. Freedom Summer, you mentioned Bob Moses. In many ways, he was the driving force behind it, although he was not alone. I spoke to him recently, and he's going to be on the second half of the show. Tell us a little bit about him. He was looked upon as kind of almost a saint.
Of course, it didn't hurt having a name like Moses, and sometimes you wonder about prophecy and how these things happen. But many people in the movement, especially the more religious people like Fannie Lou Hamer, thought his name was no coincidence. They thought he'd been sent. You know, they didn't think, of course, he was literally a saint. But he did have a very saintly presence about him. He had grown up in Harlem, the son of a janitor. His intelligence had earned him scholarships to college and eventually to Harvard for a master's program. But he had to leave that to care for his father. And he was teaching math in a New York prep school when the sit-ins happened in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he looked at those photos and he really saw a whole new attitude in the South, and he felt like he had to take part in it, and he went South during a summer break in between classes and went back the following year, and he went to Mississippi, unlike Martin Luther King and others, and he went alone. He would walk up to, in the deepest, most rural part of Mississippi, walk around the communities talking to black folks and talking about the right to vote. Of course, the word got out very quickly. He was beaten, he was shot at, and he simply refused to be cowed, refused to be intimidated, and he developed this icy calm about him. He would, even when blood was streaming down his forehead, he would lead blacks into the courthouse and say, "We're here to," speaking very softly, as you'll hear, "we're here to register to vote," and how he got out alive, I do not know. But with the stories spread and he began to have followers, and he was the mastermind who came up with the idea of Freedom Summer and became sort of its architect and its as one volunteer said, the Jesus of the movement.
So these white students, young people, came from all over the country. They went to Ohio first to be trained. You said one of the purposes was to go into the South to help people overcome their fear, that is, to register to vote. And yet, the white kids themselves were confronted with a major incident of terror on the very first day of Freedom Summer.
Yes, Moses and others went around the country in the spring of 64, recruiting at colleges like Stanford and Harvard and Oberlin, and they got 700 people. And some 700 people signed up, and about half that many showed up for the first training on a campus in Ohio. And after learning how to take a beating and hearing more stories of what they were facing, they went down to Mississippi on buses. And on the first day of summer, it was actually June 21st, a Sunday, they were met with overwhelming gratitude in the black community. It was my favorite part of the story, never told before, really, how they were paraded through the streets, and kids came up to them and asked their names, where they were from, and one man walked up to a volunteer. He said, "Son, I've waited 80 years for you to come," and he pressed a dollar bill into his hand. "God bless you all." It was that kind of the welcome for which they were not at all prepared. They'd heard all sorts of horror stories of what might happen. That evening, however, the horror stories began, and that was the night that Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Chaney I had set out that afternoon to investigate a church burning in Neshoba County, and they never came back. And no one knew where they were. They simply disappeared. Everyone pretty much figured they were dead, but the FBI rushed in to investigate. And the next day, the second group of volunteers was training in Ohio, and they heard Bob Moses tell them, three of our people have gone out to investigate a church burning. They haven't come back. And suddenly there was no need to tell these horror stories of what had happened. It was quite clear to everyone in that room this could happen to them. And you might think that many went home, but in fact almost every single person, knowing this was what they were facing, went down to Mississippi.
Remarkable courage. In fact, that church burning was meant to lure the civil rights workers, Mickey Schwerner in particular.
Mickey Schwerner was the target. He was a remarkably idealistic and noble young man who had been in Mississippi. He was not a volunteer for the summer project. He'd been in Mississippi with his wife, Rita, for about 5 months. They'd been in Meridian, and he was instantly spotted because he was, after all, talking to black people and giving them a ride in his car. Spotted and targeted by the Klan, and the fire was set at the church which was supposed to be a freedom school that summer, to lure him into Neshoba County. It worked, and the other two, Andrew Goodman, who was a summer volunteer, and James Cheney, a black man from Meridian who was Schwerner's good friend, just happened to be along.
A terrible story, and that is a story that has come into the news more recently, because finally, after how many years has it been, there has been a conviction of the main perpetrator.
Yes, there was actually a series of, the FBI investigated and did quite an extensive investigation after dragging its heels for 36 hours before going in. They were quite reluctant to. But once they did go in, they did crack the case that fall, and there was a trial in 67, but it was not for murder. Mississippi would never have pressed charges back then for murder, and the federal government, murder is not a federal crime unless you commit it on federal property, so they could just convict for civil rights violations, and they did convict, I believe, 10 of 19 men accused of civil rights violations, and they did 3 to 10 years. But it was only in 2005 that the real perpetrator, the real organizer of the whole lynch mob, Edgar Ray Killen, was tried and convicted of manslaughter, and he's still in jail.
You said the students were received with open arms by the black community. Of course, they were received by terror by the white community in Mississippi. How did the national press receive the idea of a Freedom Summer?
Well, Freedom Summer was spotted on sort of the press's radar as soon as it was announced. I mean, Moses and Snick gave public press conferences announcing they were going to be bringing all these students down, and it was initially people expected a bloodbath. They were afraid of what the worst that might happen. And in fact, Moses and Snick and students lobbied LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, the president, to send federal marshals to protect the volunteers. But of course, that wasn't going to happen. Johnson wasn't going to have another reconstruction on his hands. So once the murders happened, Mississippi just became shot right to the top of the civil rights agenda. And there were nightly reports from Mississippi showing the FBI agents wading into the swamps, dragging the rivers and looking for the bodies. But as Bob Moses knew, it also brought a lot of attention to the way things really were in Mississippi and how segregated, how stilted and closed the society was.
And yet I was impressed in your book, Bruce Watson, in your book Freedom Summer, that there were many, many pundits who, while on the one hand they, gave a nod to the terror state that Mississippi was, they also blamed the civil rights workers for going in there.
Some did, especially Southern papers, but others, the Wall Street Journal, for example, said, well, it's, of course, no one can defend what's going on in Mississippi, but Mississippi might rightfully resent all these Northerners coming in and telling them how to deal with their race problems. And there was, of course, a huge amount of resentment, quite beyond the violence of the first night. There were and some subsequent violence in which many churches were burned. Mississippi papers were filled with comments, just the most derogatory comments, about the volunteers. They called them unwashed, unshaven trash, beatniks, etc. How dare they come down, communists, of course. How dare they come down here and tell us how to run our state?
Yeah, now you mentioned Johnson. I was surprised. I mean, here Johnson had, after all, signed a Civil Rights Act not long before Freedom Summer happened. Yet he was extremely reluctant to provide any kind of protection of the civil rights workers, and later on with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at the Atlantic Convention, he was determined to shut them down, not to let them. When Fannie Lou Hamer was testifying, he interrupted the media programming. So tell us about that, and why was Johnson so, this great president for civil rights, why was he so against this?
Well, he wasn't necessarily against Freedom Summer. He was, in fact, quite sympathetic to what might happen. And there are all sorts of wonderful tapes that I quote verbatim from the White House. Johnson dealing with, talking to J. Edgar Hoover and others about what might happen. And they really feared that there would be many more deaths, not just the three. There'd be many more murders. They fully expected that. But Johnson was not going to send federal marshals in. He said, I'm not going to send troops in on my people. He felt that he remembered growing up, as every Mississippian did, with stories of Reconstruction, with stories of how federal troops had occupied the South, and this was the darkest days of the South, etc. He was not going to be responsible for that. He did sign the Civil Rights Bill that summer, and everything began to change very slowly, but it began to change. That was his major accomplishment. Of course, he would later, that summer, he ordered his attorney general to begin drafting the Voting Rights Act that really made change. But he was not going to allow the Freedom Democrats to be seated in Atlantic City. He simply feared a massive walkout from the South, and he, with his own huge insecurity, he feared that Barry Goldwater, might win the presidency if that happened. So, although he did basically sympathize with the Freedom Democrats and he didn't back segregation in any way, he saw its dangers, he could not allow these people, as he said, these people who were chosen in a hotel room, to be seated over the Mississippi delegation. He thought that'd be a disaster for his candidacy.
In fact, there was a wholesale desertion of the Democratic Party by the...
Well, ironically, even though Johnson brokered a compromise through Hubert Humphrey, his vice presidential candidate, he offered two seats to the 67 delegates, two seats at large. Remember, they were challenging to be seated instead of the all-white Mississippi delegation. They said, the Freedom Democrats said, we are the rightful Democrats from Mississippi. They said, after all, the other Democrats, they're not even going to support Johnson. Everybody knows they're going to go for Goldwater. But Johnson offered them two seats at large. Fannie Lou Hamer said, we didn't come all this way for no two seats. Freedom Democrats walked out, but the Mississippi delegation also walked out anyway. You know, they were asked to sign a loyalty oath. They said, we don't need to do that. They walked out. The whole South went for Goldwater anyway, but that's all Goldwater won, plus Arizona. So Johnson's fears seemed ungrounded. And in fact, unfortunately, that was a major break in the civil rights movement. It really, Bob Moses and others, said they played by every rule. They'd followed the book all the way down, and they saw that this simply was not going to work anymore. And that's when the civil rights movement really began to turn much more militant, was after Atlantic City.
It's a spellbinding section in your book, Bruce Watson, Freedom Summer. Now, talk about the freedom schools. You follow one young woman who's from California. It's quite a story that you tell of hers.
Yes, there were 700 volunteers, and they all had their own stories. I found four in particular. I read the letters of dozens, but I found four in particular that I follow through the book. And one young woman named Fran O'Brien from California was preparing to be a teacher, and she saw that what was going to be going on in Freedom Schools was exactly what she was doing, working with kids, disadvantaged kids, using very few materials. And so she, like many others, went down and they started these Freedom Schools. Many were met in refurbished shacks. In some cases, the volunteers themselves had gone in and cleaned up these old shacks that were just in horrible condition and painted them and made them spotless and ready to go. And they didn't even know if any students would come. It was summer, after all. They expected 1,000 students in about 35 schools, and 2,000 showed up, including many adults who came to learn how to register to vote or just to learn to read and write. And the Freedom Schools were just the shining jewel of Freedom Summer. They were just filled with enthusiasm, kids playing with the volunteers, dancing, teaching them how to dance. Freedom School teachers taught things that the black schools of Mississippi would never have taught, black literature, black history. They encouraged the students to question, why do the whites have everything? Why do you have nothing? They were a wonderful experiment in democratic education, really.
And this young woman held a secret for many, many years.
Yes, Fran O'Brien, alas, had a dark secret that she kept in Freedom Summer. And she, although she generally had an uneventful summer for the first few weeks, for the first 7 or 8 weeks, and was doing wonderful work with kids, and actually met Martin Luther King that summer when he came to Mississippi to support the Freedom Democratic Challenge.
And say what he told her.
She met Martin Luther King in a he was seated in the front seat of a car and going to where he was going to speak, and she piled in the back with a bunch of other volunteers, and they were all climbing over themselves to tell Martin Luther King what they were doing Freedom Summer. And he turned to her and he said, "What about you, young lady? What do you do in Freedom Summer?" And she said, "Well, nothing. I just work with the children." And all the other volunteers said, "Oh, no, she's doing chorus and she's teaching history and she's doing crafts and everything." And Martin Luther King looked at her and he said, "Do you call that nothing?" And she said, "Well, no." And he said, "Let me tell you something, young lady. Children are our future, and you are helping to make it. Don't you ever let me hear you say that you are just doing nothing." So it was a wonderful story that she told me. But she also told me the sad story of how one night she was abducted and beaten by the Klan. And she was waiting for a ride, and the ride didn't come, and a pickup truck came, and not thinking or seeing, just piled into it, and there were four Klansmen in hoods, and she was taken down a dirt road and beaten. It took her years to get over and to even talk about that. She eventually did, and she wrote about it as well, and she shared it with me too. It's certainly the saddest story of all these.
So Mississippi has gone a long way. In fact, you liken it to South Africa in some way. You say, you know, Mississippi has gone further than any other state in reconciling with its history and overcoming its history. What do you feel, after having written this book, what are some of the lessons that you feel Freedom Summer has for us now, echoing down the decades?
I think the biggest lesson is that you don't need to wait for a Martin Luther King, because how rare is a person like that, or even a Rosa Parks, that people can take democracy into their own hands if they take it seriously and take its ideals seriously and are courageous enough. And that the civil rights movement, which has often been reduced to King and Rosa Parks in teaching, is so much more than that. It's ordinary people. And I must emphasize not just the 700 volunteers, but the local black folk of Mississippi with whom they worked, who had been living in Mississippi and braving, risking their lives to vote before and after Freedom Summer. These people were the catalysts of the civil rights movement, and they can be the catalysts of any movement that chooses to value its own rank and file, so to speak.
Well, Bruce Watson, your wonderful book is Freedom Summer, The Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and Made America a Democracy. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next up, the great civil rights leader Bob Moses talks about the campaign to make quality education a civil right. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned.
Give your arms to struggle. If you see me crying, don't just pass your shoulder.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we heard author Bruce Watson talk about the man who many regarded as the saint of Freedom Summer, the modest, soft-spoken SNCC field secretary, Bob Moses. I had a chance to sit down with Moses when he came to the east end of Long Island. He was there to talk about his campaign to transfer the public schools by making quality education a constitutional right for all children in America. It's called Quality Education as a Constitutional Right, Creating a Grassroots Movement. Beacon Press is the publisher. After the civil rights movement of the 60s ended, Bob Moses went back to doing what he had done before getting involved with SNCC, teaching math. But in the 1980s, he turned it into a new arena for social change. He created the Algebra Project, the aim to help low-income students and students of color get the math skills they need to become full citizens of today's technological society. The project has turned into a new civil rights movement aimed at ending the last bastion of Jim Crow, our nation's schools. Bob Moses, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
You say that this issue of quality education is an issue about Jim Crow, that education is the last place where Jim Crow still really exists in this country. So could you explain the connection there?
There are two connections. One connection is that in the industrial age, reading and writing were the required literacies to access the economic arrangement. So we were working with sharecroppers in the Delta, Mississippi, who were really the serfs of the industrial age and who were really subjected to what I call sharecropper education, the idea that, well, these people only have a certain, you know, job, a certain function in our society, and so their education really is aligned to their function, right? They're going to be sharecroppers. And so we were testing that out by taking illiterate sharecroppers down to register to vote, right? So in the information age, quantitative literacy is on the table, along with reading and writing literacies. And the people who don't get it, doesn't matter what their skin color is, the people who don't get it, if they don't have a safety net, if their parents aren't well enough to actually provide them with the means for living, they're going to be the sharecroppers, the serfs of the information age, right? And you can see that coming, right? I mean, you see it coming more strikingly with black people and Mexican Americans or Latinos in the prison system, right? But it will be coming for all the people who can't access the economic arrangements, and they won't be able to if they don't have all three literacies. So the quantitative literacy is on the table, right? So that's what we were focused on, but we're focused on that looking at the legacy from the civil rights movement, which was working the demand side with the sharecroppers, getting them to demand their right to vote, with, in one sense, the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of those sharecroppers.
Moses says there was a historical difference in American history between constitutional people, people who could vote and own property, and those who were property themselves.
We began as a nation with some of our people being constitutional people, mostly white men, but then some of our people being constitutional property, right? And so we travel that road until we decide to have this enormous conflagration. You know, 600,000 of us are dead after that, in order to come to a point where we say, well, we're not going to have constitutional property anymore. Then we, between after the Civil War down to the Civil Rights Movement, we're in this twilight zone. What Amzie Moore, who was the head of the NAACP in Cleveland, who really did redirect the sit-in energy into the voting arena in Mississippi, what he said always was, well, we want to be first-class citizens, right? So this idea in my mind then, not then, but now, I'm trying to grapple with the idea of first-class citizenship in the concept of, well, we started out as constitutional property. We evolved a people who were not quite constitutional people in the sense that they had secured their constitutional rights, right? But they were no longer constitutional property.
So are you saying that, okay, they had secured the right not to be constitutional property, but they had not secured the quality of being first-class citizens, and that this is the same thing you're talking about in terms of education, because everybody has a right to have an education in this country, but that's not really the cutting edge as you see it?
So one way of thinking about the civil rights movement was that it pushed the evolution of the country around who the people are in the country that secure the rights that the country says they have, right? We pushed it around public accommodations, right? So we became a country in which public accommodations was not a dividing line separating out people. Everybody has access to those. We pushed it around access to the ballot, right? So the right to vote became a right which was secured for everybody. And we actually pushed it around access to the National Democratic Party structure. And that was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. When they challenged the regulars at the Atlantic City Convention in 1964. And so you actually opened up the National Democratic Party and allowed someone like Barack Obama to actually have a chance to be nominated, right? But we didn't push it, and it wasn't a focus of the sit-in struggle around education, right? So Jim Crow was and is really firmly established in our public education system. The person who actually nails that in writing, and I haven't seen it anyplace else, was James Bryan Conant. Remember, he was president of Harvard for 20 years, from 1933 to 1953. And he actually oversaw the transition of Harvard University and therefore all of the elite universities from catering to private school students to a network of public school students. But then he took a look himself at public school education and he wrote a little book called Slums and Suburbs. He published it in 1961. And in it, he says, the nation as a whole settled on a caste system for Negroes after the Civil War. And what shocked him was that the clearest manifestation of the caste system was our educational system. And we were fighting the caste system in Mississippi around the right to vote, right? But we don't have in the country currently a way of understanding what has evolved from the history, from the Constitution itself, down through the Civil War, down to the Civil Rights Movement, this legacy of a caste system which is manifested most blatantly in our education system.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the great civil rights leader, Robert Moses. He's just come out with a book that he's edited called Quality Education as a Constitutional Right. I asked Bob Moses what he thought of the No Child Left Behind Act, which pushed standardized testing and accountability in the schools.
If you remember when the No Child Left Behind Act was put in, and I talked to Major Owens, who was the congressman from Brooklyn. He's no longer in Congress, but he was deeply involved in the Education Committee, right, and in Congress. So what he said was that there was an agreement between both the Republicans and the Democrats around the No Child Left Behind Act, in which the opportunity structures in the act were not funded. So what was funded were the accountability structures, right? The testing procedures, right? And what happens to a school which doesn't meet the standards given under these testing procedures to hold schools accountable, right?
So are you saying in opportunity, you mean that the second part was funded, that is the testing, but not the first part, getting kids ready to be tested?
Exactly. In other words, everyone is aware that the students, the schools, the whole system is not where it needs to be, right? So the question is, what's the strategy to get the students in the schools where they need to be? And so the strategy can't be to test them as where they are and show us that they're not where they need to be. I mean, we know that they're not where they need to be, right? And this is part of the problem, you know, because all the people in the elite structures in the country have their kids in schools that they know will work for them. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're progressive or conservative, none of that matters, right? What matters is your child, and you're going to make sure that your child is in a school that works for them. And so it's the other people's children that the country has not really come to grips with, right? We don't have a sense in this country that all the children in the country are children of the country, and all the children in the country need and deserve this quality public school education. So this is a big issue, and it's tied up with the distinction between, well, what are the rights of a person as a citizen of a state, and what are the rights of a person as a citizen of the country?
What do you mean by that?
So in 1883, the Supreme Court ruled on what were called the civil rights cases, because Congress in 1875, I think, had passed the first civil rights bill. And they wanted at that time what we got in the 1964 civil rights bill. They wanted access to public accommodations. And the Supreme Court said, no, Congress can't grant that, because you're dealing with the rights of citizens of states, and the state has the right to say about who has access to what public accommodations. So this has been a long tussle in our country. What are we citizens of? So for purposes of going to war, clearly we are citizens of this country. But for purposes of public accommodations, we didn't become citizens of the country until 1964. And for purposes of the right to vote, we didn't become citizens of the country until 1965. Before that, we were citizens of the state. Well, for purposes of our education, we are primarily citizens of the state.
The book Moses edited, Quality Education as a Constitutional Right, talks about lawsuits in both California and Texas against the schools, demanding they provide enough resources to poor schools to enable their students to succeed. Moses talks about the Rodriguez case in Texas.
As an offshoot of the civil rights movement, right, in the late 1960s, 400 Mexican-American students in high school in San Antonio marched out of school and marched downtown to the education offices. And they are demanding a facility that's actually worthy of students and also teachers that can actually teach them. So their mothers get together and decide that they're going to help them fight. And they go through the legal process, and a case lands before the Supreme Court called the Rodriguez case. And the issue is equity, that they get money from the federal government to change this situation. And they're asking for the same amount of money as happens in the well-funded suburban districts. So the Supreme Court says, you really can't come to us for relief. You really can't come to the federal courts for relief, because there's no substantive federal right to an education. And the operative word there is substantive. There may be some kind of formal idea about everybody has, you know, an educational right in this country, but it isn't substantive as a national federal right in the sense that you can go into the federal court system and ask for relief.
So Obama has talked about creating national standards for schools, in some way taking out of the hands of states the ability to discriminate on standards. Is this what you're talking about in terms of a federal right to education, or is there something else that's needed here?
Yeah, so, and notice how they went about doing it. So what they did was announce a race to the top fund, right? And they said that in order to actually get some of these funds, you have to develop as a state certain standards. And so they're trying to get the states to say, we will adopt these standards, and the states are chasing the money. Not every state. Some states it says, we're not going to go after this money, you know, and meet what you say are the things that we have to do. So it's a way to try to waffle around this issue, and it raises a really deep question, which is because, of course, all of these states need money, and the greatest discrepancies in the country are not within states, they're between states. So the greatest discrepancies in terms of funding are the states in the Northeast and some of them in the Midwest, and all of the states from California all through the Southwest and all through the Deep South, right? That's where the greatest discrepancies are. The person who's really analyzed and looked at this is Goodwin Liu, who is a law professor out at University of California at Berkeley. And Liu is the one who has written an article in the Yale Law School Journal really arguing that there is already a constitutional right. And it's a constitutional right which he says it's the obligation of Congress to act on. And he's arguing from the point of view of the first section of the 14th Amendment, not the equal protection section, which says, well, if a state has some good or benefit, it has to distribute it equally among all its people. But the first section, which says who the citizens are in the country, and arguing that there's substance to the idea of being a citizen. And you can see that substance as you trace out the idea, well, who are the citizens who have the right to access public accommodations? Who are the citizens who have the right to access the vote? Who are the citizens who have the right to access the national party structure?
There's one big difference, though, I think, between the public accommodations issue and the education issue, and that is that with public accommodation, poor whites had access to any, you know, to accommodation. But when it comes to education, here race and class kind of shade into each other, because when schools are funded by property taxes, you can have rural white communities, such as in western Massachusetts, where the show originates from, where there's very poor communities and poor schools.
Yes, so this is a big issue in the country. We actually are doing the Algebra Project in a little town called El Dorado, Illinois. It's near the Kentucky border. It has just about 4,000 people in the whole town, and the town is poverty-stricken, right, because of the moving of the whole industrial base out of. And I mean, there may be a couple of black families in the town, right, a few. So it's a town which is rural, poor, Appalachian, white, and you see the same kind of response in the educational with the students as you see in the inner cities, right, and in rural black communities. So this issue has two taproots at least, right? There's a racial taproot, but there's also a class taproot.
Now, you were a great leader of the civil rights movement. You were a field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Summer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. SNCC was a youth movement. And you are saying that this educational movement, this movement for the constitutional right to a quality education, also needs to be a youth movement. Why?
Right. Howard Zinn has a really telling description of Jimmy Crawford, who is a young SNCC field secretary, just a teenager who's joined SNCC in Southwest Georgia and is accompanying black women up to the registrar's office, and then he recounts a dialogue between the registrar and Jimmy, and the registrar is challenging Jimmy, basically asking him, who do you think you are to be bringing people here to my office, asking them to register to vote? And he's challenging Jimmy at the level of, what would happen if somebody tried to actually shoot you, right? Or if I got somebody to actually try to shoot you? And Jimmy's beating down all of these questions. But the registrar is persisting, and he wants to know, why are you doing this? And Jimmy comes out and saying, it's my job. And then he says, well, what will happen if you are murdered or something like that? And Jimmy says, well, all the people will come, right? And he says, well, who are these people? And these are the people who gave me my job. So the issue for us in this country, because democracy doesn't really work unless somebody has Jimmy's type of job. And for a brief period of time, SNCC really inspired, or really it was the sit-in insurgents, and then SNCC, which inspired young people to take on a certain kind of job. And so one of the questions for the country is whether it can produce, in the 21st century, young people who take on this job. And it's the job, really, of, in the broad evolution of the country, of continuing the evolution of the idea, who the substance in the idea of the constitutional people, right? So who the constitutional people are, is it going to extend down to every child in the country that they are really citizens, constitutional people of the country, that this has meaning? It has meaning in the sphere of their public education, that the country is going to commit to this for every child in the country. So it's a way of saying, this is work that has to be done. It has to be somebody's job. And really, it's only the young people who are going to be around for the rest of this century, if it takes that long. That's the job, I think, of the young people.
Moses' son, Omo, is spearheading the Young People's Project, an offshoot of the Algebra Project. It hires students to teach other young people mathematics, and it hires students to teach other young people mathematics and helps them become grassroots leaders in the struggle for quality education as a right for all.
The Young People's Project, one way of thinking about it is that what I absorbed from Ella Baker was an idea about leadership, which was an organizing idea about leadership, which is part of what an organizer does. And she did it for the sit-in movement. She created an event and a space in which they could emerge as the leaders of a network which represented what their movement was about, right? Because the sit-in movement spread like wildfire. But what she did was say, well, look, you all have to take responsibility for what you're doing, but you have to be conscious. And she wasn't intending, and never did try to step in and lead that. What she did was create a space for the leadership to emerge. Well, we took that into Mississippi, right? If you think about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, we were not the people who had the credential to go and challenge the white regular Democrats at the National Convention. It had to be the Fannie Lou Hamers of Mississippi to do that. So you needed a consciousness that you were going to create a space for people like Fannie Lou Hamer to emerge and get together with the other people like her in order to actually do this challenge.
So you're saying it couldn't be the organizers themselves. It had to be the people they organized.
Yes, exactly. So the SNCC organizers, they could go to the National Democratic party and try to create mayhem. That's what they could do, right? But they couldn't go there and actually work within the structure to call the attention of the structure to this deep issue of its caste quality and its legacy. I mean, and Mississippi, of course, was the perfect place to do it because in 1875, it was Mississippi that threw out Adelbert Ames, who was the Republican governor, by force and violence and terror, and took over the Mississippi state legislature as Democrats, because it was blacks that had elected the Republican governor. And so really it was really Mississippi's, that was the venue to do this, right? I mean, you're looking at almost 100 years of history where the Democratic Party in the state of Mississippi had been taken over by force and violence, and now almost 100 years later, black people are saying, look, we need a different kind of party down here.
For Bob Moses, people like Fannie Lou Hamer had legitimacy because their lives in themselves were the embodiment of the struggle for civil rights.
She was carrying in her bones the authenticity of her life, right? And so there was no way to deny, right, what she was talking about. No one could go up there and talk about the Fannie Lou Hamers and have the impact that Fannie Lou Hamer had. So I think of that as part of what we were doing was working the demand side, right? So it's one thing to advocate on behalf of people. It's quite another thing for people to demand themselves, right? People who are in the condition to demand. And they have to earn the right to demand it. I mean, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, part of what allowed her authenticity was the severe beating that she got at the Winona jailhouse, just trying to go through, right, and have a cup of coffee, right? She was traveling from South Carolina back to Mississippi, and the bus stopped at Winona. So back then, people earned their right with physical, you know, violence against them. The students also, and this is what the Alger Project is saying, they have to earn their right with their minds in this case. They have to demonstrate to themselves first, and then to a wider community, and then eventually to the country, that they can actually engage this issue of education, because the country isn't going to pay any attention to a student that's out there in the street, and then you look at what they're doing in school, and they're not attending to school. They're just going to say, well, that's the reason they're not doing well in school, right? That's the argument that's out there now, right? So there has to be an earned insurgency, but it has to be led by the people who are suffering, who are under whatever these conditions are. So, and they can call on everybody, right? It's not something that they alone can do. And this is what we did in Mississippi. I mean, we called on the young people from all across the country to come to Mississippi. But how did we earn the right to do that? Because you were calling on people to step into danger, to step into losing their lives, possibly. And so what did you do to earn the right to do that? So that's part of what we're looking at now.
Bob Moses, thanks so much for talking with us here at Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Francesca.
Bob Moses was a key leader of Freedom Summer in Mississippi in 1964. He also spearheaded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and founded the Algebra Project. Listeners, thanks so much for joining us. Continue the conversation at writersvoice.net. You'll find much more about the campaign for education as a constitutional right, and you'll have a chance to give us your thoughts on the issue. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.